Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR. Larry Mailer here, and welcome to the Book Club. We're talking today about the book, The Restaurant Inspector, and we have author Alex Pickett with us all the way from the UK. Alex grew up in a small town, Wisconsin, Milton, and now resides in London, where he teaches creative writing. And The Restaurant Inspector is his first novel, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. He has a new book coming out called Camera Lake. I think it's coming out in July. But we're talking about The Restaurant Inspector today and want to hear from you. If you've read it, tell us your thoughts on the book. What did you think about the characters? He wrote some pretty complex people into the story, for sure. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Alex Pickett, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really delighted. I love you and your show. It's so great.
Well, I tell you what, I really enjoyed your book. It's a wild ride. That's for sure. Rather than me explain it, why don't you give us the sort of the background? What's the book about?
Well, it's about a lot of things.
Yes.
I mean, I was going to have a whole like cast of characters at the beginning. It shifts perspective between a lot of people in the town and a lot of people from outside the town who come into the town. But I think at the heart is a possible foodborne illness kind of ravages the town, though it's unclear how much of that, the mass hysteria is human made and how much of it is actually a virus or an illness. I went from the restaurant inspector's perspective because he's kind of a hub for all these other stories, right? All these, like, the bureaucracy and the restaurant that might be, you know, people think might be involved, and all the people blame him. So it's all about like shifting blame around. And I find that stuff hilarious. I find it's a very serious situation that I want to turn into a ridiculous one.
Oh, man. And you've got a Russian interference. You've got...
Yes.
A lot of small town power play politics going on. And the restaurant inspector himself, Arthur Riley, is kind of a hapless character. We'll talk about that as we go along. I started reading the book without any sort of background. I just picked the book up, started reading it, really got interested in it. And then I thought, gee, this is kind of a follow-up to COVID in a way. And then I thought, no, wait a minute. I went back and I went to your site and took a look at your site and found out that you wrote this beforehand. And it was actually, it started as a thesis paper for your MFA.
Yes. Yeah, I started it way back. I started it like pre-2016 election, I came up with the story. I mean, I published it before COVID, like it was accepted for publication, but because of publication cycles, it came out in 2021. By the time people had COVID story fatigue, I think, and epidemic fatigue. And it was more like, I don't want to use a plot device, but it's this one, inciting incident, an illness that infects a bunch of people and people reacting wackily towards it was just something to get a restaurant inspector in every part of the town. I mean, in 2015, I wrote that people were wearing masks in the town. And as I was typing, I stopped. I was like, I can't do that. That's too ridiculous. People would never wear masks in a small town like that. And I was like, well, it's a farce. So I'm going to just do it. And it kind of, by the time it was published, it was like a realist novel that started as a farcical one after 2016 election and after COVID. So everything that I thought was over the top ended up kind of hitting right in the middle of where our lives somehow got to.
Well, yeah, people were wearing masks, but there was a forced there was a forced curfew, but it was lifted for a Packer game.
Well, it was only on DirecTV, so you have to go to the bar for that, you know. So that's where the town would have had too much and not accepted that punishment.
Oh man. You do a really nice job. It's set in a small Millsville, this small town, and you do a great job of making it feel real, I think. And maybe talk about your own childhood. You grew up in sort of small town Wisconsin, we could say. How did that shape this book?
Well, it's funny because I'm the only person in my family who was born in Wisconsin. We're Iowans by way of Arizona, and then, so I was born in Prairie du Chien. I moved to Stoughton. I moved to Neillsville. I moved to Milton for high school. And then I left and got out. And then I came back, graduated from Madison, and then left again, went to New York. And then I came back and lived in Milwaukee. So I have like every Wisconsin experience that you can possibly have. And so it's kind of, but I always felt like an outsider. Like I never had roots in Wisconsin, right? And so I feel like that allows for all these different perspectives. I mean, even, you know, Millsville is the name of the town in the book, but like it's kind of a mixture of Milton and Neillsville, where the two towns I kind of like came of age. I was like elementary school in Neillsville, which is more north in the state, and Milton high school, more southern part of the state. Very, you know, pretty different, but still some of the same fundamental small town Wisconsin aspect.
Yeah, it's interesting. Part of my research, PhD research, was in involved Neillsville.
Oh yeah,
I was born in Stoughton, Wisconsin, and of course,
really?
I was a professor here at the University of Wisconsin. So yeah,
well, no wonder this book spoke to you. It's just like all of the same influences.
It really did. And the dark comedy part of it. You know, what draws you to dark comedy?
Well, I think I was like, my brother's a comedian. He does something called the Found Footage Festival. It's been going around for 20 years, and like my family, we try not to take anything seriously, so I gravitate towards comedy. And so I went there in that register. And then I showed a friend of mine, Kenan Ferguson, who teaches at UW-Milwaukee. And he liked it, but he was like, you can go darker. You know, he's like, I think you've established the characters in the story enough where you can go to dark places and not lose the audience. And so that kind of allowed me, like freed me up to go to the darker spots because I you know, you have to kind of earn it by not putting your characters through the ringer for no reason. But yeah. I think that some of these themes and some of the story just calls out for going to those places to reach different registers. So the funny parts are funnier and the darker parts hit harder when they, you know, kind of that are dashed in.
Yeah, there's, what's the German word? Schadenfreude, which essentially means getting pleasure from another person's misfortune.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think Wisconsinites, I mean, I'm one of us, and I think we love it. We love that. And you know, so I love it. I'm not proud of loving that, but I do. And so putting my character, I mean, I also just love extreme situations, you know, like I don't necessarily need my characters to be miserable, but that is the extremes of life, right? Is going to these extreme, like I put Arthur, the restaurant inspector in the story, through so much, and he just deteriorates, his clothes get all messy, his car gets wrecked, he gets beat up. And I just needed that to be the marker of plot, because I just love extreme situations. You know, like I love that, like I don't like violence and I don't like gratuitous violence because you've seen it before and it's not that interesting. But I love putting characters in bad, tough spots and seeing them beat up and bloodied and messed up. And, you know, so yeah, I think it's just funny. Like most reasons for why I do things are like, I think it's funny.
Well, You know, talking about the characters, and I had a list of the characters, you know, the main ones, of which there are 12 or 13, if I'm thinking about it properly.
At least, yeah.
So, and a great strength of this novel is the characters. They're very much, in my mind, real people with flaws, and I want to pick your brain a bit on how you formed those characters. What was the process like? How'd you decide their strengths and weaknesses?
Well, my favorite story about how, like, of all the characters, my favorite one is that when I met my wife, the person who's now my wife, when she found out I was a writer, she's like, you can never make a character based on me. And I agreed to it, but she never said I couldn't make a character based on her father. So that's Sasha, the Russian interference of the story, is her father. If her father didn't care about the law, like if he really, like he already, like he'll do anything. Like he's just like a hustler, and he's like this. He's like a Ukrainian Soviet Ukraine immigrant who just like is just a bear. He's just like, she calls him like Tony Soprano. He doesn't do anything illegal, but he's just always like hustling, and he gets in fights with supers of buildings and, you know, that kind of thing. And so I really tapped into him because he's just such a character. And I felt like I don't want to do too many like aspects of characters that I can't identify with. But with him, I've spent so much time with him that, I mean, he's hilarious. And so I said, like, what if he didn't have a sense of right and wrong? And then that formed Sasha, you know, but also my father-in-law loves his daughter so much, and that's like the redeeming quality of Sasha, I think, is that he, once his daughter gets involved, then you see the humanity in him, and that's what I think connects a character to the reader.
Yeah, and the daughter Anna is not after your wife.
No, she is not. I distinctly made her not. Every physical feature I made different. How, like, it's like very different from how my wife would act. she would have called me out on it, and I agreed. So I didn't go back to my word.
Well, so what about the other characters?
Well, like Adam, who is a flat earther, who believes in the power of magnets and colors and copper wire. That is based on my grandfather. He did that. He was arrested in Nebraska, in Omaha, Nebraska, or Lincoln, for putting copper wire with colored beads on them in the air ducts of government buildings, because he thought that would fix the government and make the government run more efficiently. I toned him down for Adam. I mean, Adam's a pretty functional fellow, but I grew up with that. I grew up with that character. So I just wanted to see him and then, you know, humanize him and make him an interesting, functioning character. Of course, I paired him with Sasha in the beginning of the book, because I love how they play off each other.
Yeah, there's an irony to many of the characters. And as long as you mentioned the newspaper editor, Adam, he's not a smart guy. Very intelligent guy, but he's also a flat earther. So there's conflicting ideas about so many of the characters.
Well, and that's the tough part to write. That's where you really have to sit with it and be like, how can these two things, and research too. I mean, you research flat earthers. Hey, that's just hilarious, and you should really do it and look up their conferences and look up how they justify things. But there are people who are functioning, you know, other than that belief, rather intelligent people. And so for me, fusing those two aspects of a character together is the fun part, both to write and to read. Like, I'm like, oh, that's a great problem to have today, is figuring out how somebody can both be an intelligent human being and believe the earth is flat. Which, I mean, there are some people who do it. I mean, hopefully I pull it off, because I mean, it was too good to pass up. I mean, just as a problem for myself, and as a game kind of, well, and then getting readers to come along with that is, I mean, it's hilarious to me.
Well, I really enjoyed it. And that was a part that I really, really liked. Alex Pickett, our guest today, He is the author of The Restaurant Inspector. It's his first novel, published by the University of Wisconsin Press, which I think is pretty cool as well. And you can join in. I'll give you a chance now. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email, the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org, or talk@wpr.org. In fact, why don't we use that one? talk@wpr.org. Go there if you want to email in a question. Jill Nadeau and Clara Neipert are producers today. Jeff Robbins, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR for our book club selection. And we are visiting with Alex Pickett. He is the author of The Restaurant Inspector. It's his first novel published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Comments for him. Have you read the book? Give us some idea of what you thought of it. If you have a question, maybe about Midwest Nice, what's your experience been? The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Which character did, you know, you're talking about how you were sort of patterning a few of the characters after your people that you know well or related to. Which character do you identify with the most?
I mean, it's easiest to say, you know, Arthur, because he's the main character, but I like to write characters who do things that I don't do. I don't care about rules as much as Arthur does. I mean, honestly, I mean, I already mentioned Adam. Like, I'm a weirdo. And so, like, I can, like, that's where I kind of, like, I can see how people believe things that don't exist, you know, and are obviously not real, but, like, you have to, I think that's maybe a more creative way of thinking. I mean, with Arthur, obviously, with a restaurant inspector, I mean, I was an inspector in New York, and that's how I got, you know, the basis of knowledge for this and how I came into writing it. And so I did use my actual experiences the most for his character. But I just had him act in a different way than I would and did generally.
You know, you held a wide variety of jobs. I went on your site again, and I saw a piece that the Janesville Gazette, you did with the Janesville Gazette. I read that, and I thought, holy cow, this guy's been around a lot. I think it'd be fun for people to hear a bit of your background.
So, I mean, I graduated from Milton. I went to a university in Seattle for a bit. I dropped out immediately because I didn't want to go. I moved around. I went to California, worked in, like, a factory out there for a bit. I went to Alaska, where I worked in a warehouse and a cemetery for a summer. Worked at a, I don't know what they call it, memorial park or something. Doing maintenance there. I came back to Madison. Then I went to New York after graduating college at Madison, and there I was for, I don't know, a couple, 3 years, was an inspector for the New York City Parks Department. And there I would inspect anything that basically made money on a park. So it's everything from hot dog carts to Tavern on the Green, Shea and Yankee Stadium. They have weird marinas there, one of which was always featured in Law and Order, and was, I mean, I was frightened to be there. Stables, all this stuff, and all five boroughs in New York, and there was only two inspectors to inspect all this stuff. And I mean, once I got locked inside the Central Park Carousel, because we had reports of people relieving themselves inside barrels inside the carousel, and these large men who worked there, and I believe it was owned by a former president of ours at the time, and the carousel, not owned but operated by, and these large men locked me into the Central Park carousel. So I mean, it's a lot of various experiences.
Well, you know, it was interesting to me because I've talked with a lot of authors over the years, and one thing that I see in many authors is they have done all kinds of things. I mean, it held a lot of jobs, maybe for a short period of time. That's something that might not look good on the resume.
I was about to say, it does not help with prospective employers. It doesn't quite endear you to people who want specialization nowadays. But for writing a book with like 15 characters who are all doing different things and bureaucracy to running a hot dog cart, it helps to have that firsthand knowledge. I didn't have to do a ton of research for a lot of what went on. Mostly that's for like characters from places that I don't personally know about or have experienced things that I don't personally experience. But I was able to pull a lot of it just from my time wasting jobs. Right? I did odd things.
I was thinking about my, and for me, as somebody who's on the air talking about a whole variety of topics, I was thinking about my own experiences. I delivered potatoes and produce to restaurants, and I ran some heavy equipment, and I was a carpenter. I built some houses, or helped build some houses. I taught wild game cooking classes.
But my thing is, like, I still like doing, like, I mean, I, you know, since coming to London, like, I don't like working. I like writing in my own stuff, but then if I have to make money, because, you know, these things don't make a ton of money, I gravitate towards, like, I worked with like refugees and like asylum seekers here, like taught like a men's group, taught creative writing there for, you know, not much money, but it's very interesting. I worked in the homeless sector, like homeless shelters, like overnight homeless shelters and things. And that to me is just, that's like what I, it doesn't feel like work. It just feels like experiencing life in this certain way.
Yeah.
And that to me is, like, I'd rather make money doing something like that than, you know, I mean, writing books is writing books. And I think that a whole life of having these weird experiences has, like, you know, conditioned me to seek out odd jobs. I should probably stop, I think. But,
Well, Luke in Waukesha, I think, has a question. Luke, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Sure. I've got a question for Alex. Knowing that a lot of your readers are not from Wisconsin or maybe not familiar with Wisconsin, I'm wondering how you approach, you know, telling the funniest Wisconsin stories and sort of playing up maybe the best and worst aspects of Wisconsin in a way that's compelling, but that doesn't reduce small town Wisconsin to a caricature. How do you balance that?
That's it. Great question. I think that, like, where I'm coming from with writing is it's been so long, like, I've been out of Wisconsin so much that I filter it through the people I know, you know, that I lived with in New York and Florida and Alaska and London. And I think I'm filtering it through that lens of incorporating other experiences. I mean, even when I'm writing about, you know, a Russian character, Albanian character in the book, I think, how is it going to be both authentic and universal at the same time? You know, it also helps having people read it. I mean, one of my thesis advisors, Michael Hoffman, is a great poet and translator, and he's German by way of London. And when he read it, he was like, oh, I feel like I know the Midwest, but he would also have these tweaks. And so having people read it who aren't necessarily, you know, coming from the Wisconsin perspective helps to round it into shape in that way as well.
Luke, thanks. So, you know, writing a book that's humorous but not insulting, I think, is what he was kind of getting at too there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's, I think that's just being a kind human being. Like, I never want to make anyone feel bad. I think that's ultimately where it comes from. And if you're just like an empathetic person, I think you can kind of slice away that hard edge, because I don't want to alienate anyone, and I don't want to have one person like the book at the expense of another. I think it's more difficult to not to not go low like that. And so you always want to do the most difficult thing when you're writing. Though it is easier to laugh at people, I think, and to make fun of people. It's a tough balance, and it's a lot of editing, I think, and just reading it over and over and seeing, if that person read this, would they know that I'm, laughing with them and not at them, kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Luke, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you. I want to go back to Arthur for a minute. He's, the main character, restaurant inspector, and so much happens to him in this book. And actually, there's one time, and I couldn't find it. I was looking through to find it because he runs through his own mind of what's happened to him. And it's like, I wish I could find that again. But he does talk about himself, and let me just read from one. He says, all I did was fail for no reason. I tried to live a normal life. I couldn't do it. I had nothing to overcome, and I still needed help to live. It's humiliating to fail at being average. He's telling that to the newspaper editor. What? And I thought about him. Is Arthur the cause of his own misfortune, or does he simply have bad luck?
I think that's up to the reader to decide, because I just love when people don't have any obstacles and still don't succeed. There's no redeeming quality to that, and not even failing bad enough to not having personal tragedy or anything to become sympathetic. It's just trying to live a normal life. Even without obstacles, can be difficult, and I don't know. I think it just speaks to a fear that I have, like that passage. Like I love that you picked out that passage personally, because I think that's like that. It's one thing if you aim high and don't hit it, but if you aim middle and you don't get it, then it's left to say, like, is it my fault or is it like the universe? But I don't think Arthur believes in some big power of the universe, so I'm sure that he would say it's just his fault, for making wrong choices just not being smart enough or talented enough.
Yeah, sometimes I thought it was probably his fault, and sometimes I thought just darn bad luck.
It's definitely his fault in that he just needs to be more flexible at times. And I had a friend read this, somebody talked to me who read it not a few weeks ago, and they were just like, I love a character who loves following rules. Like, and Arthur loves following rules, but it shows that when you follow rules too clearly, the rules just don't make sense. And so I think that's where his fall comes from, that he trusts in the rules too much, maybe.
I read something from the book, and I haven't even asked you to read something from the book. I kind of like what I picked, but what have you got a piece that you want to read for us?
I can just read from the beginning. I'll read a couple of. It's broken into segments. There's prologue, and it kind of follows the characters around. Yeah. I'll just read a couple of segments from it.
Yeah.
Adam Bender took a break from fighting with his wife to look out his bedroom window. It was 2 a.m, and he had just heard a door slam outside. In a moment, he saw his neighbor, Arthur Riley, running down the block at full speed, wearing only a bath towel, which he clutched to himself. It was much too cold outside to be running like that. Earlier that evening, he had heard the first frost warning of the season on the radio. Adam had been surprised to hear the door slam, to see a man running in only a bath towel, until he realized it was Arthur. If anyone had a reason to be running like that right now, Adam reasoned, it would be Arthur. Adam wore a vivid yellow pajama top and multicolored pajama pants that were decorated with flowers and parrots. The fight he was currently having with his wife, one where he was in the moral right and wielding his justness in just a way where he could take a break to go to the window, not be outwardly crushed by the sight of her sobbing on the bed, was in large part because of Arthur. Even so, as he watched his friend rounding the bend of their street, high-legged and powerful, completely determined in his path, Adam couldn't help but be impressed at Arthur's newfound determination. Before turning back to his wife to resume their quarrel, Adam thought how even 2 days ago he had never seen such resolution in this man. It would have been a shame to miss it.
Yeah, that's that was from the opening, and I love that opening, and it goes on further, and he kind of Arthur runs by other characters, and it was really a nice way to and an exciting way to open the book for sure. Patrick in Oregon, Wisconsin emailed, he's looking forward to picking up a copy of your book. Wondering if you have any advice for aspiring novelists with full-time jobs. Can you share a little of the journey of publishing your first novel? How'd you land at the University of Wisconsin Press?
It's a great question about working full time. I mean, I always take inspiration from, like, there's a lot of doctors who become novelists, Chekhov and William Carlos Williams, and people who just, like, between patients would write. And I always think, like, if they can do it, then I can do it while working some, you know, a job that gives me some days off. And, like, yeah, but it is hard. And I know a lot of people who give up, and it's a lot of banging your head against the wall when you don't have the time to focus on it day after day. I got my MFA, and that's where this started. I mean, I took a class with Jill Cement, who's just a great novelist, a wonderful teacher. And she, you know, had a course where the whole semester, we just wrote the first three pages of our novels over and over again in these different styles. And that's where I hit on this opening. I didn't know how I was going to get to where I was placing these characters. And that was really fun, just to kind of have these endpoints that I could, you know, change as I went along. And then, you know, getting to UW Press, I mean, I a friend of mine, Kevin Ferguson, I mentioned him once, he just talked about their fiction list and how strong it is and how this would really speak to them. And so I edited it over and over and over. It used to be like 500 pages. I cut it way down. You can keep going when you have this many characters. And so I edited it to just like as clear as it can be, as clean as it can be, and sent it off. And luckily they took it. I mean, it's publishing is really difficult these days. It's all about determination, in my opinion. If you just don't give up and you outlast everybody, you can find a home. And I love UW Press. I went to them for my second book as well. It just, they're nonprofit press, but they have really great, hardworking people working for them. And their fiction list is amazing. I mean, I've sent people their way who are publishing books, and they're really amazing.
You know, that whole bit, you mentioned 500 pages or whatever, and let's see, let me look here. This, it turns out to be 274 pages. And, you know, I was thinking about my own life on this a little bit too. Is the student will say, "Well, I'm applying for a graduate program at Harvard. Could you give me a letter of recommendation?" Well, I write a letter of recommendation, and that, you know, this is like a two pager or less. It can only be one page, and I will write that rough copy, and then I will edit it down. And in the end, it sounds like, you know, something that probably just came off the top of my head, but it's a lot of work, just into a letter, let alone you're looking at 500 pages and to pare that down.
Yeah. And it's both on a line by line, sentence by sentence basis. And I mean, with all these characters, if there's like an extra half a page per chapter, there's so many chapters in this that it turns into, you know, you pare that down, you cut out a storyline, you But with all these interlinking storylines too, anything you edit, you have to go back and make sure that all these other threads don't contradict what you cut. And so it took so long. I had all these sheets of paper next to my computer that I was just constantly writing down and making sure that every character was given enough time and enough space on the page to justify being there. It's a lot of work. And like, if you saw me during the edits, I mean, my partner can attest, I was going, like, it really makes you crazy. You have to keep it all in your head. I don't think I'm ever going to have these many characters, at least told from this many perspectives again, because it's a lot.
Well, yeah, I was thinking about that. I mean, if you change something, like on page 200, mm-hmm. about a particular individual, and you know, as you say, you've got 12, 13, 14 main characters floating through this. Then I got to go back 200 pages, go through 200 pages of straight.
And it's not only plot. It's also like, would that character do this? Okay, I have to remember this other time where they did something similar, and they can't act in a different way on page 8 because I've established the character there. So on page 250, they have to be consistent, you know. And so, just going back and searching through all that stuff. Oh, it's a lot, but it's worth it. You know, I mean, books are worth it. Like it's in the world, and like, I'd never regret any time I spent, even if it was never published, I wouldn't regret any time spent perfecting language, especially.
Alex Pickett is our guest today. His book is The Restaurant Inspector. That's the title. A dark comedy. It's really funny. And many parts. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts as we move along here. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking about The Restaurant Inspector with the author of the book, Alex Pickett. And coming up after noon, you'll hear from a real-life restaurant inspector about her job as well. Plus, we'll talk a little about food safety, maybe some tips to keep in mind at home. But you are now welcome to join our conversation. You grew up in a small town. Tell us what it was like. Maybe gossip spreads fast, or everyone congregated at the sole local bar to watch the Packers. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Linda emailed us to say, hello from Milton. She hasn't she hasn't read the book yet, but she's looking forward to it. She's curious, are there any nods to Milton within the book or the characters?
The Milton Family Restaurant, I think that I use Millsville Family Restaurant, but it's not based on that restaurant. Although, you know, it has some similarities. I love the Milton Family Restaurant. I'll promote it right here. So we go there for breakfast all the time when I visit. It's a very specific thing, but the road behind my parents' house in their subdivision that leads up to this area where there's just this lone house, and I think they just kind of stopped like building houses, so there's just this one over the hill. That's Arthur's house in my head. I was walking around when I was visiting and writing the book, trying to figure out where like that action took place, and there's this perfect spot. There's no street lights. It just stopped. I was like, that's where Arthur would live. So I wrote like this very specific street. I don't know, it's near my parents' house, if you can find that. And there's other nods. I think Neillsville is more represented in there. I had Chatty Bell, the world's largest talking cow, in there. I switched it to a goat because my mom was the voice of Chatty Bell in the 90s. She worked at the pavilion in Neillsville, the WCCR, whatever the radio station
is. Yeah.
And she has a great speaking voice, and so she was Chatty Bell until I think the mechanism broke, and then somebody else recorded it. So I had that in there, but I switched it to a goat because I just thought it was more ridiculous. And I didn't want to place it so specifically. So Milton's a little normal. Like, Milton's a more normal town, I think, at least compared to the other places I live. But the Milton Family Restaurant, I wanted at least a nod towards them because they're amazing.
This concept of Midwest Nice, which you kind of, you take a look at that in the book. What does Midwest Nice mean to you?
I never thought specifically about it, though I think people like dramatic events and they like gossip, but if you don't know someone, you just want to be nice and kind of get the interaction over with, unless if you're chatty, in which case you're probably genuinely nice. And then to the person who's Midwestern nice, they'll just kind of put up with it and not be impolite, but really want to get away. And I think that's, you know, that's more my style. I'm kind of introverted. But even now, like, I would never over the airwaves of Wisconsin, because I love Wisconsin. I really do. But I would never say anything bad about it because I don't know the people listening. And so I don't want to offend anyone ever. Though behind people's backs, I will be, I'll say what I really think to people. But I think it's very similar here in England. In certain parts, like, people are very kind to your face, but the Brits are known for their, you know, acid wit and their takedowns. And, you know, I find a lot of similarities between Wisconsin and England, to tell you the truth, like, from the food and how people interact with each other. You know, the pub culture is very much like the bar culture, I think, because it's very family oriented. It's very, you know, and people are very nice to your face here, just like Wisconsin.
Permanent politeness. Well, this whole business about some people associate Midwest Nice with passive aggressiveness. Come right down to it. What do your characters stand to lose by not saying the hard parts out loud?
None of this would happen. It's kind of like, you know, if people would just say maybe a painful truth or ask questions that might get them in trouble, all of this would be averted very quickly, and it wouldn't be a good book, certainly. There would be no drive to it. It's that holding back. But that's why I think placing a story in a set place, not just a general, you know, town in some general region, it's the Wisconsin-ness is necessary to the characters, which are necessary to the plot, which is necessary, you know, to the various themes and things. Because if it isn't real to the characters, then it's just a plot device, right? Then it's just this thing that you'd be like, oh, that would never happen. But in Wisconsin's like, absolutely, people would keep this vital information or keep, you know, just to stay out of trouble, just to not feel bad, you know, themselves about making someone else feel bad. There's a part towards the end where Arthur sees somebody coming out of a bathroom and she's really ashamed that he saw her come out of the bathroom. And it doesn't have anything to do with anything. I just put it in because I was like, I just want to keep that in. It made all the rounds of edits. And he was just like, why do people care so much about being spotted doing normal human things? Like, you know, that to me is Wisconsin. People, you're doing something everybody does, but you don't want to admit to it, or you don't want to, you feel like you're caught if you're seen being human for some reason.
You know, and I think this is true of not only Wisconsin, but probably at least every Midwest state. Let's put it that way. Newcomers. So you've got Sasha and Anna, Arthur and the Bagnoni family are frustrated with feeling like, okay, I'm an outsider.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of jokes. You know, I've heard people say, well, I've only lived there 20 years, so I'm still considered a newcomer.
Well, and that's where I have always come from in Wisconsin. Even though I was born there, I moved from town to town. I was always the new kid, you know, and so like I never had these roots. Even within the state, you have to have the roots in the especially in small towns, I think, in the town, you know. So like I was always looking at it from behind some kind of a barrier or something. I was never quite integrated, which is probably why I got out so quickly after after high school. But, you know, and my parents have been in Milton now for 35 years. They might, I think that they are probably now maybe part of the town, you know?
But yeah.
There's still this sense of if you weren't born there, even if, you know, then you can move away and come back and you're still part of there. Adam moves away and comes back, but he is still part of the town. He has these roots in there. That you can't get. You can't get roots if you don't begin there, I don't think. And that's been my experience of small towns. Maybe that's more of being a kid growing up there, but well, I always felt that.
Yeah, I think that's true of small towns all across the country.
Oh, and probably here. I think definitely in England here, you know.
Does that bring on a loneliness, do you think? Is that part of...
Yeah. Probably. I mean, our family's very close, I think, as a result of moving around. And so you get these different roots and different connections. But yeah, I think my characters tend to gravitate towards loneliness. I don't feel like a lonely person, but I think that I understand it from, you know, being a part maybe as a kid, that kind of growing up with that, I think kind of sets a tone. And I think loneliness, you know, it's interesting writing as long as you don't dwell too much on it.
Yeah.
But having that background or that deep-rooted sense of loneliness, I think, is both sad and moving and connects people to characters.
One other area is this whole business of corruption. and most of the characters deal with corruption in one way or another, yeah. Whether it be government corruption or moral corruption. some characters feel like they have no choice but to bend or break the laws. And the kind of corruption shows up, you know, pretty often in The Restaurant Inspector.
Yeah, no, I think... I mean, that's my cynicism, I think, coming out, my deep-rooted cynicism with... especially government stuff, but I think just people. I mean, Arthur, about midway through the book, like, gets corrupted by passing along blame when he knows it's not true. Spoiler alert. And I think just showing that metamorphosis and showing that either, like, a character who's just fine being corrupt, and then maybe you show their background, and then, you know, like, Sasha, the Russian, the Ukrainian guy, you show his background. It's like, oh, I understand why he would do that. It's the systemic pressure over time corrupts people. Or, you know, you have to do what you have to do to take care of yourself and your family.
And Tomato, I don't want to give everything away, but tomatoes play a role in your book. Why'd you pick tomatoes to be featured?
A, I'm just not a fan of raw tomatoes, and so I could feel that. And I think people from Wisconsin aren't the most adventurous food eaters, and so they can, like, having, like, people be like, oh, I never liked tomatoes anyway. On a more practical note, which you could ask your next guest, which I can't wait to listen to that, by the way, is, I believe I'm right about this, tomatoes are vectors of foodborne illness because they're difficult to wash and you don't often cook them. And so if it's uncooked, you chop them up, you put them in a salad. If there's something on there, it just stays on there. Plus, I will say at the time, during my research, there was a trade dispute between Mexico and the U.S. And so then, you know, Mexico could be blamed for the illness via the trade done for the tomatoes. So, yeah.
And I got a big laugh out of one scene with Katie and Sasha, I think, and a tomato sandwich.
Oh, yeah, she made a tomato sandwich. And he didn't know that.
I got a nice laugh out of that one.
That was my favorite to write. I just love preparation of food and then to have it have an evil ending.
Alex, you've written a wonderful book. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It was a lot of fun.
I really appreciate you having me on. I'm such a fan, and it's a real honor to have me on.
And I hope we get a chance to talk about your new book next time, Camera Lake. It comes out in July. We don't have time. I ran out of time here to talk more about it, but it's coming out in July. It has nothing at all to do with restaurant inspectors, I'm pretty sure.
It's it's a short story collection. So it's still pretty Midwestern-based, still a lot of the same humor and oddness of the book, I think, but different context.
And the title of that one is Camera Lake.
Lake.
Camera yeah. Lake. Alex, thank you so much. Appreciate it very much. And thank you. And thank you for listening in and stay with us. We're going to be talking to a real restaurant inspector coming up next. I'm Larry Mealer, and you are listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. Well, we just finished hearing about life of a fictional restaurant inspector, and now we're going to learn more about the people who make sure your food and mine is safe to eat here in Wisconsin. Larry Mealer here for WPR. Great to have you with us. Carrie Paiola is our guest for the rest of the show. She's a food scientist in the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection's Division of Food and Recreational Safety. And as we talk with Carrie, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. What do you want to know about food inspection or food inspectors or maybe about food safety? Maybe you're cooking for a big group of people soon, like I am this weekend, and wondering how you can prepare a meal that's safe. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Carrie Paiola, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry. I'm pretty excited to be doing this.
You know, there's a line in DATCAP's Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection's Food and Recreational Safety Consumer Information webpage that says food safety is everybody's job. It starts at the farm and ends at your table. So maybe talk a bit about about that idea.
Well, first and foremost, I'm going to say safe food saves lives. We all need to remember that. As part of the DATCAP, the Department's Food and Recreational Safety Division, we do a lot. We provide oversight of all things food, whether that is your dairy, your manufactured foods, your meat and poultry products, restaurants, which is kind of what the book was based on, the old restaurant inspector. We also look at retail stores, so your grocery stores, your smaller retail stores as well. Thinking about going to a temporary event like the Wisconsin State Fair, we're out there doing inspections as well. We also encompass recreational programs, which a lot of people aren't really familiar with what a recreational program is. If you like to camp, we're inspecting, educating, monitoring safety at campgrounds, bed and breakfast establishments, lodging. This includes those home rentals on the short-term basis. I know VRBO and Airbnb have exploded. Swimming pools, those huge water parks down in the Dells, we're looking at those, as well as your recreational education camps. I do want to mention a lot of our jurisdictions do provide this inspection, the inspections on behalf of the department. And so then we, again, train and evaluate those inspectors who are doing those inspections. Wisconsin is a national leader in supporting the growth and safe operation of diverse food, lodging, and recreational businesses. And we do this by educating and regulating businesses in a fair and effective and efficient manner. So we do a lot.
you do. And I actually have a couple of friends who are now retired from DATCAP who were food inspectors. One, I believe, worked in the sort of the dairy area, you might call it. And Jim worked in the, more or less the meats area. And so I know a little about some of the things that they did over their careers. Maybe describe a day in the life of a food scientist in the Division of Food and Recreational Safety. What tasks do you complete every day? It sounds like you might be involved in a range of tasks.
I am involved in a range of tasks, but I specialize in retail food. So those other gentlemen you mentioned were a specialty in the dairy program or in the meat program. I specialize in restaurants, retail food stores, meat lockers that are retailing food. So what I do as a food scientist, and I used to be the boots on the ground inspector as well, I help train inspectors throughout the state that conduct those inspections. We also evaluate them, and we standardize those inspectors so that everyone throughout the state is getting a uniform-type inspection. So if I were to go in and inspect a fast food restaurant and somebody else on the other side of the state were inspecting that same type of fast food restaurant, they should be getting a pretty comparable inspection. So a food scientist, again, we're kind of technical experts, but a big part of our job is evaluating, training, standardizing our retail food inspectors that are out there, your boots on the ground in the field.
So, I don't know, what's the most rewarding aspect of being a restaurant inspector in your mind?
Oh, gosh. I'm going to say this, and some of my coworkers will probably cringe because they know this about me. I love a good puzzle. I love to really work with that restaurant that is having a difficult time, maybe following regulations and really working through that kind of puzzle with them to get them on track. And I love those aha moments where you're talking with them and you're providing suggestions and all of a sudden it's like the light bulb goes off, their eyes brighten up. And that really makes my day. I really love the educating and working through some difficult situations that we come across within retail food establishments.
Yeah, I can see where that would be a great thing. I was just thinking about my own career. One of the jobs I had many years ago was to deliver potatoes and produce to restaurants and grocery stores. And so I was in the kitchen of, I don't even know how many restaurants over the course, 50, 60 restaurants anyway. So I was in restaurants where, the kitchens of restaurants where I thought you could eat off the floor. They were so clean, and others that were not quite up to that standard. And so I suppose there you might call the minimum standards that must be met. And it's probably not, I'm sure it's not only having a clean floor.
A clean floor is a very small part of it.
Yes, I would guess.
So I know a lot of people see the surface type issues within a retail food establishment. CDC has actually developed or put out what they deem the five risk factors. So the five risk factors are those situations that if they are not controlled, they would directly contribute to a foodborne illness or outbreak. And those five risk factors, I preach them every day in my life, improper cooking, improper holding, approved source, contaminated equipment, and personal hygiene. So if you hear those five risk factors, you don't hear mention of clean floors at all.
No.
So people think of dirty restaurants. There's bare minimum we would like to see. We love cleaning and maintenance because that's going to help support a well-run establishment. But a lot of our inspectors, what they really focus on now, no more of the floors, walls, and ceilings, it's those risk factors that they're looking at that are really directly contributing factors to making people ill.
Yeah. And, of course, restaurants, I imagine grocery stores might be in the same sort of mode. I mean, you need to meet certain standards in order to be licensed, right?
Correct. You do. And, again, the guidelines or our administrative code that we set forth, those are the bare minimum guidelines that a facility needs to meet. So our regulations, what people don't realize, that's bare minimum. That is, if you're controlling it following these regulations, you most likely will not make somebody sick, and you will have a pretty well-run establishment.
So what? How often, say, does a typical restaurant get inspected?
Restaurants are actually required to be inspected annually. If they're conducting higher risk processing, like lots of batch cooking, so they're making lots of food in huge batches and they're cooling it down. If they're doing what we call a special process, if they want to get a vacuum sealer and reduce oxygen package things, then we want to do inspections on those facilities more frequently. If it's a problem facility and they have lots of violations, we're going to be in there more than once a year. But your typical routine inspection should be happening at least once per year.
You know, there's some things that I was thinking of. One had to do with allergy information, things that are on menus, educational things. You know, somebody could say that a dish is gluten-free or maybe it's dairy-free. That'd be another example.
Mm-hmm.
Do you verify? I mean, are these statements verified by by DACAP?
So, if something is already labeled as it's, when it's coming in to an establishment as gluten free or has some sort of claim to it, that's usually done by our manufactured food inspectors. So, those are the businesses that are wholesaling. When our inspectors are in, and I just want to add, the newest, there was the big 8 allergens. There are now 9. Sesame has now made the list. So if you see sesame on menus or labels, you want to make sure they're indicating that as an allergen. What is required at retail is labeling. If they're going to package for sale products, they need to label and provide allergen information on the label. And there needs to be some sort of demonstration or working knowledge of the operator, manager, and staff of allergens, what allergens they may have in their establishment, and recognize effects or reactions to allergens.
Yeah.
So not quite as in depth as in our manufactured food world, but there are some basic requirements that need to be met at the retail level for allergens. Yeah, allergens are really, really, really scary. I've heard stories of a child at recess, goes to lunch, eats a peanut butter sandwich, goes to I'm from up north, the water fountain or the bubbler, gets a drink of water, and then another kiddo goes to get a drink from that same water fountain and goes into anaphylactic shock just from that little bit of contact from that kid probably having residual amounts of peanut butter on their fingers, and then that other kiddo goes into anaphylactic shock. So yeah, food allergies are pretty scary.
They are indeed. Can the public get access to inspection reports for restaurants, or how can they if they can?
They can get access to public or to inspection reports. I think the easiest way to do it is to Google Wisconsin Department of Agriculture. And then once you are there, you can search on our website. There's that little, usually they have the little search bars for restaurant inspections. It's going to bring you to the landing page where the link that houses the inspection reports will take you to find those reports. So then you're going to see a list of counties, and within the counties there might be city jurisdictions that are providing inspection services. You just have to drill down and find the area of the establishment. So a lot of our franchises might have multiple establishments within that jurisdiction, like a fast food or a quick service place. You want to make sure you're looking at the right for the address for the right establishment. But absolutely, we have those reports online. You're going to see the violations. You're going to see temperatures taken, sanitizers. So I think you're going to see notes. You're going to see a certified food protection manager who's certified or done that education to ensure safe food within that establishment. Mm. So, yeah.
I bet a little remiss here in not giving the phone number. If you'd like to join in, maybe you've got a question about inspection or maybe you've got a food safety question, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We just finished talking with Alex Pickett about his great book, The Restaurant Inspector. Tomatoes played a role in the book. And tomatoes can cause some food poisoning. What do you need to know about growing your and eating your own tomatoes?
And that is correct. Tomatoes are what we call a time temperature control for safety food if they're cut. So some basic things when you're growing tomatoes at home. You want to make sure that you're growing them away from runoff or areas of contamination. We don't want to see you growing tomatoes in old industry waste containers like 50-gallon drums that maybe had some sort of chemical in them. Make sure you're using only fertilizer soils and feeds intended for growing produce. Now, the real important thing in my book, what we oversee, is once you harvest those tomatoes, they can be stored at room temperature. However, once that tomato is cut, you want to make sure it's refrigerated and held for no more than 7 days at 41 or below. So you might ask, how do I know if my refrigerator is holding at 41 or below? You can buy some pretty cheap thermometers at your local grocery store, your big box store, probably Amazon. They hang right in there. Or you can get yourself a food thermometer and you can just set it in there or just check the food every once in a while. 41, you want to remember, 41 or below. My refrigerator at home operates at 38. I will tell everybody that's listening in. FDA and CDC, I think back in early 2000s, actually made cut tomatoes a TCS food because there were outbreaks associated with tomatoes. So we always think of tomatoes maybe having a lower pH. That pH is not low enough with that water activity, that moisture, that juiciness in that tomato, to support the growth of salmonella. And I've had family members that have had salmonella. It's pretty scary. So when we're thinking of cut tomatoes, we want to make sure once they're cut, you refrigerate them, throw them away after 7 days. I also want to mention what a lot of people don't realize as well. This also applies to cut leafy greens like lettuce, spinach, cabbage, including red cabbage. Also your cut melons. You know, making sure to wash the outside of those melons really well. When I'm talking melons, honeydew, watermelons, cantaloupes. And finally, a lot of people get bumper crops of tomatoes. So if anyone out there is planning on canning tomatoes, be very cautious. Follow an approved process. Botulism, you don't want to roll the dice with botulism.
No.
So yeah. So tomatoes are... there were a lot of outbreaks linked to tomatoes. So FDA, CDC, the Center for Disease Control, they said, yep, we need to get some stricter control on cut tomatoes.
Helen in Appleton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Helen.
Hello, Larry. Thank you so much for the show. I'm really enjoying it. Something that just popped into my head, I love a lot of the cooking channels. And I noticed so many of the chefs, when you're watching these programs, they're not wearing any gloves. There's no hair nets or any protective gear that way. They're sweating profusely, and I'm wondering if that's ending up in my food. And so I think about, well, when I go out to dinner, are there chefs in the back kitchen? Are they wearing gloves? Do they wear hair nets? I don't see any of that anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, I love this question, and these cooking shows are the bane of my existence. Oh, my gosh. People poking at meats and everything else. No, in your restaurants, if it is a ready-to-eat food, they have to wear gloves. We do allow for bare hand contact in certain situations. 98% of your establishments choose to wear gloves. Proper hand washing. We want hand washing between changing tasks, especially going from raw meat to or raw poultry or raw fish or raw eggs to your ready-to-eat food like a deli sandwich or something like cutting tomatoes or lettuce. Hair nets are required. If they're prepping, processing, they need to have hair nets on. Hair needs to be restrained. We get a lot of crazy questions about hair. Any hair needs to be restrained. Sweating sometimes is a little out of our control, especially in the summer months in Wisconsin. Kitchens get really hot. We just tell people to do their best. If they've got to wipe their brow, go remove gloves, wash hands, re-glove, and continue going back to work. So, yeah, the cooking shows, oh, my gosh, I watch them and I just cringe sometimes.
thanks so much for that question. And Cindy and Mosini had a comment about bathrooms, I believe. Cindy?
Yeah, yes, I do. I'm a housekeeper. And when I go into an establishment and I use their bathroom, if the bathrooms are disgusting, more than likely the kitchens are too. So
you
that's
just
the way
leave.
I feel about it.
Yeah.
Cindy, that's usually what I tell people. Check the bathroom. It gives you a pretty good indication how they're keeping up with the kitchen. Yes, but again, bathrooms are required to be maintained per Wisconsin administrative code. So we want to make sure that bathrooms are maintained, that they're not a source of contamination.
Well, Carrie, we're going to have to get you back. Here we are out of time. We'll have to get you back to talk some more about this. There's a bunch of things that we didn't cover, but I appreciate your time today and thank you so much. And hopefully we can do this again down the road.
And Larry, I just want to put in a quick plug for our listeners today. If they're looking for information, they can DATCAP or they can Google DATCAP. Otherwise, they can go to datcp.wi.gov, G-O-V. That'll bring you right to our webpage, and we have all sorts of information on our website.
Carrie, thanks so much. Carrie Poyola is a food scientist in the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection Divisions of Food and Recreational Safety. We'll get her back and we'll do this again. Thank you so much for listening in today. Tomorrow is Garden Talk, and Melinda Myers will be back with us to answer your gardening questions. So looking forward to that as well. Lots of fun today. I hope you had a good time and stay with us. Lots more in store on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mehler.